Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking with a neuroscientist who's sort of an authority, leading authority, if you can have leading authorities, on Alzheimer's disease. His name is Professor George Perry. He's the SEMS Foundation University Chair of Neurobiology at the University of Texas, San Antonio, and was recently recognized as the Texas Academy of Science Distinguished Scientist for 2020. So with all of that, you better be very knowledgeable and erudite, Professor Perry. Hello.
Well, it's a pleasure to be speaking with you today, Keith, and talking about one of my favorite topics, not a favorite disease, but a major focus of my research over the last nearly 40 years.
Absolutely. Well, we want to go back a little earlier than, you know, recently, and even maybe the first 40 years of studying this disease and neuroscience. How did you start out? When you were a young boy, did you have visions of being an academic in science, or how did all that develop?
I didn't have a vision of being an academic because I wouldn't have known what that was. But I think probably by the age of five, I had an idea that I wanted to be something like a scientist. I grew up in one of the most isolated coastlines in Southern California, Point Conception. Yeah, my father was a tenant farmer of the farmland that was on this ranch, and we were 27 miles away from a small city called Lompoc. So even when it rained, we couldn't leave because the roads became muddy. Even with a four-wheel drive Jeep, you couldn't get out. But this offered incredible opportunities to observe nature. The Point Conception is the mark between the northern and the southern currents along California's coast. So it's extremely diverse marine life as well as terrestrial life. I self-studied it by reading books, et cetera. I didn't have an idea of an academic, neither of my parents had finished high school.
I didn't have any view toward
what it would be like to be educated or any of those things, but I did know that I wanted to know more about the things around me. I subsequently studied marine biology at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and Woods Hole and Hopkins Marine Station of Stanford. But when I went along for further training, I departed from marine biology to biomedical research, primarily because there was more employment options than there was in marine biology. And eventually, that first change was at Baylor College of Medicine, where I studied cell biology. And then subsequently, I went to Case Western Reserve University, where I studied Alzheimer's disease.
Well, it's quite a journey. And the interesting part for me, and I'm sure lots of listeners, is that in a sense you didn't have any role models when you were this young child. What you were doing is just observing what was around you, and that was sufficient just to keep you, well, not keep you, but sort of stimulate you to find out more about what was around you.
Correct. What I did is I used to go to the library, check out some books, look through them. When I was in high school, initially when I lived in this ranch, my first 2 years were in a one-room schoolhouse, grades 1 through 8.
What was the name of your teacher?
Boy. Oh, Mrs. Holt.
Holt. All right.
Yes. And there was only one teacher for all 8, right?
Yeah, no, I'm with you. And it's amazing how many stories come out of a situation like that. You know, now we've got thousands in schools and hundreds of teachers and visiting teachers. And yet, here we are, one teacher, one schoolhouse, and now one recognized internationally expert on Alzheimer's disease. Does that surprise you, looking back?
I wouldn't have described the school as being one that I would have thought inspired academic excellence, okay? My brother and sister both went there all 8 years, and it was quite a challenge for them when they went to high school subsequently, because they only learned what the expertise was of the one teacher. So if the teacher was an expert in math, they learned a lot of math. Or one case, there was a teacher that was expert typist. So my brother and sister are exceptional typists.
Okay, well, that's interesting. And did they go on to different careers, or did they land up using fingers?
My sister probably went into the fingers because she was a secretary.
Right.
And my brother, computer-related things.
All right. So anyway, but the famous one-room schoolhouse, I don't know too many equivalents of that, like in Britain, where I grew up. But here it's just it's an icon of early education.
Correct. I think this was one of the last places that had a one-room schoolhouse. My father was on the Board of Education and received an award from this county of Santa Barbara as being the longest-serving trustee. I think because he was unopposed. And so...
That's the way to get a successful career in public service, you know.
Yes, and my father had only an eighth-grade education.
Right.
But my father encouraged me to be educated, though.
Yeah. Oh, no, obviously. And tell me, one final thing before we move on, is do you keep in contact with Miss Holt?
No, not at all. I mean, I would doubt that she's living at this point. Time that she was at an advanced age.
Okay.
During the time she was teaching there.
Sometimes I think, you know, I've made contact with some of the teachers I had, not at that early age, but at, you know, grammar school, high school. And they're always so happy to have you wander into the schoolroom where they are. I mean,
that is true for my high school teachers.
Right.
I have maintained some degree of contact with them. Some are not living also.
Oh, yeah. That just shows how old we are. But we'll pass that by and carry on to the topic that really I want to get into. And this is your expertise on Alzheimer's. Now, before we get into what it is that you do and how you've got a different gestalt for this disease, let's just remind the listeners and myself in particular, what is Alzheimer's? It's not just one single feature, but tell us in your terms, but in lay terms also, what is this disease?
Well, the disease was first described in 1906 by Alois Alzheimer, and it's a definitional disease. So it's a cognitive loss, dementia, that is associated with certain pathological changes called plaques and tangles. So that's the definition of it. As we move forward studying people that have cognitive loss of advanced age, and advanced age initially would be, well, of aging, that is generally people over 60, and when I use the word advanced age, I really would mean over age 85, that there are other reasons you could have a cognitive loss that are not Alzheimer's disease. Most thought is that about 60% of it is Alzheimer's disease. Alois Alzheimer's described this disease in a young individual in her 50s. She had a lot of neuropsychological problems, paranoia, other issues. But she had the plaques and tangles, and how he was able to see them was that a technological development that happened during the late 1800s, the so-called silver stains. These are histological stains that allow you to see abnormalities in the nervous system.
But this is after she had passed away.
Correct.
So there's no way to look at plaques and tangles for a living person.
That's one big technological advance. There are ways with imaging, PET imaging, to now visualize not individual plaques or individual tangles, but the amount of abnormal tau, which is the component of tangles, and amyloid beta for plaques. You can visualize those in living patients. Whether you can diagnose the disease is still a little less clear. There's been a move to diagnose patients based on biomarkers like the amount of amyloid in the brain. But the problem with that, it's been known since the late 60s, early 70s that there's really a poor correlation of this pathology with the amount of dementia. People that have Alzheimer's disease by definition have these changes, but the extent of them correlates very poorly with the amount of cognitive loss.
So people can have lots of these plaques and tangles and yet be not subject to any form of dementia, at least at the time that they've been diagnosed with these plaques and tangles.
Yes, you got that exactly right, especially advanced age. Most people that are over 85 have extensive amounts of amyloid in their brain and may have no signs of dementia.
Okay.
No correlation.
So that's a sort of an overview. Now I think it would be useful for me anyway. Tell me, please, George, what is a tangle and what is a plaque?
So the neurons are the cells in the brain that communicate with each other, working much like transistors in a computer. They're the ones that integrate information and decide whether they're going to relay that information to another neuron. And that's how the brain works, is communicating among neurons. During Alzheimer's disease, neurons die. Although, again, it's not correlated, the amount of neuronal death is not correlated with the amount of cognitive loss, but there are neurons that are dying. And
well, hang on a minute, because just healthy people, neurons are dying also, and new ones being created, or is that not
correct? Amount of neurons that are being created in the brain is minimal. There are some areas of the brain that have renewal. We actually don't know how much renewal there is. Some areas of the hippocampus have it, which is a part of the brain that's important in memory. Generally, when you lose a neuron, you've lost that function and it's not going to be replaced. And the neurons that are at a risk of death develop cytoskeletal changes, changes in the structural proteins that support the cells, and one of those proteins, tau, self-assembles into fibers that fill the neuron. And those are the tangles.
Okay.
And they're made of filament. The fibers that are formed are called paired helical filaments because they look like two twisted filaments around each other. And the plaques are extracellular changes, and they're a breakdown product of a membrane protein. And that breakdown product is about 40 amino acids that, again, assemble into filaments. They're not paired helical. And they form these structures called plaques that are within the brain. And that, why there's been so much focus on the latter is because certain genetic forms of Alzheimer's disease have strong linkage to amyloid formation. Mutations in amyloid precursor protein, the larger membrane protein, are linked in people having Alzheimer's disease, as well as two proteins that are important in forming the amyloid called presenilin-1 and presenilin-2. These are all of three of these proteins, which link, are rare conditions. Generally, there's just small clusters of families. The only exception to this is a family in Colombia, the country of Colombia, which has hundreds of members.
That's interesting. We have to take a short break. We'll be straight back. This is Keith Pannell with Professor George Perry at UTSA, neuroscientist, talking about Alzheimer's, and we'll find out what his particular area of expertise is when we come back. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell in El Paso, Texas, and Professor George Perry at UT San Antonio, neuroscientist. And George, before we took a quick break, you were pointing out, and you said several things which I wasn't aware of, and that is that there are genetic components to this disease. And in fact, for example, I think you said in Colombia, that there's a group of people that have this disease, but in a different form, or for a different rationale, perhaps, than, say, people here in El Paso or people in London or wherever. Talk about the genetic aspects a little.
Well, the strict genetics of Alzheimer's disease is that in other words, if you contain an altered gene, that you're going to develop the disease for sure is extremely rare. We're looking at less than 1% of Alzheimer's patients. And those involve three genes, presenilin-1, presenilin-2, and amyloid precursor protein. And these mutations do not improve your life functions. So, and if you have an early onset, it's going to reduce your amount of children, and et cetera.
Oh, it's got a whole range of different aspects.
Well, because you're going to end out having the onset usually of these is in the 40s.
Ah, I see.
So you're going to be quite aware that it's in your family.
Okay.
And people would very often probably reduce their, you know, the number of children they would have, et cetera. And the exception to that, in fact, it's been for two neurological diseases, Alzheimer's disease and prior to this, Huntington disease, which was explored in Venezuela, that you have families that have thousands of members. And why that's useful is because you have a homogeneous group of patients that could be studied. And why it's unfortunate is that you have people in their 40s that are suffering from Alzheimer's disease when they normally would be quite viable.
I understand. So now, I understand also, at least I think I understand also, that there's a sort of a general feeling in the lay public that somehow these amyloid plaques are what cause Alzheimer's. And I think that that may be not something that you agree with. So tell us a little bit about where you think the current state of the art is in terms of understanding, as it has been with respect to amyloid plaques, and how you think that may be untrue.
Well, so you're describing what's called the amyloid cascade hypothesis, which when it was first suggested actually was a simple explanation for how Alzheimer's disease might form. And that is that alterations in the processing of amyloid precursor protein, the large transmembrane protein, would produce more amyloid, and that that amyloid would have a toxic effect on the brain, leading to neuronal death and dysfunction in communication between neurons. But the problem with that idea was, and why this idea came about, again, to emphasize, is because the three proteins I talk about, the one mutated, all relate to amyloid production. So therefore, the simplest explanation is that that is the cause of Alzheimer's disease. Well, then it was tested by, most recently, the most elegant test is removal of amyloid from the brain by pharmaceutical approaches, particularly antibodies, but there have been other approaches. And there's been no benefit for patients. In fact, if anything, the patients have gotten slightly worse. So about 20 years ago, not having the benefit of these human trials yet, but just our own observations, both in cell culture, animals, and human tissue, we observed that wherever there was amyloid, there was an antioxidant effect of that amyloid. There was actually a reduction of oxidative abnormalities. Oxidation is the process of the oxygen reacting with us and causing damage. It underlies some of the aging process and probably plays an important role in various disease processes. Well, when we studied amyloid in this process, we found it actually reduced oxidative stress proportional to the amount there. We actually were able to show how it did this. It was through copper chelation, copper binding, which is an important oxidative stress metal. And so we suggested the idea that maybe amyloid, instead of being the cause of the disease, was an important response to the disease, that the real underlying problem probably is metabolic, related to the aging process, and we did studies along that line, and that removal of amyloid would actually have a negative effect, certainly not a positive one, and it'd be very much like inflammation, where you have an insult to the brain or any part of the body, and your body reacts to it to try to repair it. That doesn't mean intrinsically that amyloid is always good, but simply removal won't have benefit. And probably why I had this different view of it relates to my original training as a biologist, and that is that things that occur in biology that are common responses have selective advantages, or else they wouldn't occur.
That's interesting. And it also intrigues me that somewhere in the middle of this, there is a little copper. Presumably it's copper 2 or maybe copper 1, because they have this redox oxidative process.
We've actually shown both.
All right.
Just in a study we haven't published yet.
Okay. And well, I won't ask you to talk about non-published work, but, I mean, that's very exciting.
We're very excited about it. The method we used was in collaboration with a group in England, although the work was actually done at Berkeley. And that is that it's a synchrotron microscope, X-ray microscope, that actually can directly measure the redox state of metals.
That's really important. And so where does that lead in terms of, I mean, what most people want, of course, is not necessarily an explanation of a disease, although that's fundamentally important before you get to the thing that people want, which is, quote-unquote, the cure. I mean, where do you see that possibility going in the next decade?
Well, if we focus all of our effort to try to... to remove amyloid, as we've been doing for 20 or 30 years, I don't see us going very far. We instead try to work with the amyloid system. And that isn't as simple as just removing copper either. Because what we think is happening is that the copper that gets bound by amyloid is actually becoming the antioxidant that we're examining. In other words, it's acting as a redox pair.
Right.
But we're still working on that because all of the ideas along that pathway are kind of unprecedented. We've been looking for activity called ferrooxidase, the ability of copper, iron to change the redox properties of iron. And certainly we know that iron has been reduced and oxidized because we're able to find iron 2, iron 3 couples also in plaques and tangles. But we haven't directly shown that it's related to the copper.
What other metals? Because I'm an inorganic chemist, and there's a range of different metals. Are there any other metals involved in the brain?
In Alzheimer's disease, the one that's the longest studied is aluminum.
Well, yes, that was when people weren't supposed to drink out of aluminum cans. And I remember that particular. But
there are still people studying this.
Yes.
And there was a paper just recently, within the last month, from England, not from a group I'm working with, but I know them very well, in which they showed aluminum is associated. The metals I study are the ones that are redox active, and aluminum is not directly a redox active metal.
Right. So what is the consensus these days of the role, if any, of aluminium, also known as aluminum?
Depending on which side of the ocean you're
right.
on. Right. Yes. The consensus is, I would say, is that it accumulates with the lesions of Alzheimer's disease. It's been suggested by Exley that it plays a role in the disease, but that piece, I would say, there isn't a consensus on.
Well, you know, you talk about copper, you talk about iron, and then there's zinc, and there's a whole range of these metals, transition metals in their case, that have many, many, many functions in our body. Aluminum, where does that come in our system?
It has no known function in the body, except it displaces other metals from where they're supposed to be bound.
Okay, so, I mean, it does have an impact on metalloproteins. I mean, I don't know enough about aluminium because it's a very high oxidation state, 3+, so it's a lot of charge.
Correct, but it doesn't have any ability to undergo redox, to my knowledge.
No, precisely.
It does bind to the same binding sites as iron.
Okay, so it does displace irreversibly, effectively.
Correct, because its binding is extremely strong.
Right, okay.
So it's quite a toxic metal by screwing up the normal organization of metals, as well as binding so strongly and precipitating protein.
There we are.
But there's very little you very little you can do to avoid aluminum. It's the most common metal in the Earth's crust.
Absolutely. And so I'll just have to carry on. Well, I should drink out of bottles, not cans, I guess. That's my...
I don't know if you're going to get that much aluminum out of cans. They have a lining inside and metallic...
Well, the oxide covers it. I understand that.
Yeah, and the other issue is the biggest issue for aluminum in water, would be water supplies if it's acidic.
Okay, yes, absolutely.
Cooking in an uncoated aluminum pan,
right.
Something like vinegar.
Yeah.
That may not be the most prudent idea.
Okay, but we don't have a lot of time left, and I want to get to the sort of feeling here. When science is interesting, and science often, it's difficult to put out a theory or an idea, even with experimental data, that is contrary to what most of the referees who are going to look at this. tell us about difficulties you've had publishing at the beginning when you came up with this other approach.
I don't have complete difficulties publishing. I published a lot. I would say that I wasn't greeted. I had difficulties publishing, which I still do, in the journals that require consensus of the people. So there's some journals that really are dominated by orthodoxy.
Yes.
And they're the ones that have carried forward the amyloid theory all this time. And I'd rather not name them, but they are pretty obvious.
Right.
The ones that have impact factor over 30. And really have, I would say that many of those journals, by promoting orthodoxy, have created a lot of the problems in the field by not being open to other ideas.
Especially, it's one thing to have an idea, but it's another thing to have an idea with data to back it up. I've got to interrupt here because we've run out of time. Just to repeat, we've been talking, having a conversation with Professor George Perry from the University of Texas in San Antonio. World expert authority on Alzheimer's, and go to the literature. Look him up, George Perry. You'll see a picture of him. He always looks so smart, or very, very smart. You almost look like a banker, George, I must say that. But thank you so much for being here on Science Studio, okay?
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And Sam Cassiano, thank you for putting it together, and thank you, the audience, for listening, and we'll be back next week with something very different. Take care. Bye-bye.